I just wanted to tell you a little bit of background about Lehmann. Born in 1888, died in 1976. Born in northern Germany, made her debut in 1910 in the Hamburg Opera, in a bit role. For all the people who think you can't begin in a bit role, she was just a page, you know. And then her second performance, she was one of the boys, one of the genies in the Zauberflöte. And so that's how she began. And then there was an opening for her to sing Elsa, and she learned Elsa very quickly and sang Elsa to great applause. And then they knew that she could handle it, and she was getting more and more serious on stage, and she got more lessons as well, and was finally spotted by Gregor, who was the intendant of the Vienna Opera. He'd gone there to Hamburg to hire a tenor, and by mistake heard Lehmann sing, didn't hire the tenor, but offered Lehmann this contract so that she was making the equivalent of like $400 a month, and overnight she was going to be making the equivalent of $4,000 a month. She couldn't believe, I mean, the zeros at the end of the numbers just were beyond her credulity. And so though she had established so many bonds of friendship in Hamburg, she went to Vienna, was very out of place. You who don't know Europe don't realize how different Northern Germany is from Vienna. Northern Germany is much more straight-laced and straightforward, and Vienna is much more of the South and much more laid back and more flamboyant. The singers are I think they're more prima donna-ish.
Oh, don't you remember, tell the story about Maria Goeritz and her maid. You know that famous story.
Come tell the story.
Well, they always say the Balkan that starts in Vienna. The Balkan, that is not being in a very positive way to say it. It's not very kind. It's like, you know, you get on the tram in Vienna and people smell like onions and B.O. And in the north, they're a lot more, let's say, fastidious. And I mean, it's not insulting, but it's really true. I studied in Vienna. I remember, I hope, no, yeah, it has nothing to do with Hungarians and Balkan or anything, but it was like, it's another mentality. And Lotte Lehmann did feel out of place there. And the biggest star on the planet was a soprano called Maria Goeritz. She was the absolute star of Vienna Opera. And Vienna has always had prima donnas and prima tenores. And in those days, singers traveled with servants and in Rolls Royces as much show off the stage as on the stage. And this Maria Goeritz sang Turandot, which Lotte Lehmann didn't really sing, and she sang all the parts of Lehmann as well. All the parts. It was a beautiful, beautiful voice, and she was a beautiful woman. So she was vicious to Lotte Lehmann. Absolutely vicious.
She felt threatened.
Yeah, Lotte Lehmann. Because Lotte Lehmann got attention. And that was the way that she dealt with colleagues. It's not very nice. I had it happen to me, but not as bad. Things calmed down a little bit after Lehmann's time. People, you know, the show of being a prima donna got much less. There were singers that came that were not prima donnas. But Maria Goeritz was in her dressing room, and Lotte Lehmann went by, and she was going to her dressing room, and she said to her maid, she said, "A moment, Lotte, yeah, come here. And then she spoke, not to Lotte Lehmann, but to the maid. She said, "Tell me, what part do you think we could give Lotte Lehmann to sing on the stage?" I mean, and Lotte Lehmann told me this story, and as she said it, she got more and more angry. She remembered it like it was yesterday.
But it was 50 years later.
Yeah, and then she told me that like 10 years earlier, she had gone to a reunion of sorts with Goeritz and a couple of other famous singers. I think this the tall tenor Melchior, you know. And she said, and Maria Goeritz looked really old. Because Lehmann was very beautiful even in her old age. She was always sort of tan, and she had very white teeth. She didn't wear glasses. She heard perfectly. She was robust, you know. And Goeritz had gotten old. She said, and she kept on her sunglasses so no one could see how old she was. But it was still really, you know, she got it in there. She dug her.
Even after Lehmann's death,
yes.
Holden,
yes.
Madame Lehmann's friend, held the torch against Goeritz, who had been dead for years.
Yes.
It was funny.
But But the thing is, Yuritsa was a terrific singer. She was so different from Lotte Lehmann, though. It was a totally different singer, but they were both good actors, and they looked good. And so it was a big rivalry.
Interestingly enough, Yuritsa did not record well.
No.
You can buy the same aria or the same song sung by Yuritsa or by Lehmann, and you say, well, what's all the fuss with Yuritsa? It doesn't sound exciting
to me. Cold.
It sounds calculated. But on stage, evidently, she was beautiful. Lehmann was more Hausfrau, and Yuritsa was really the glamour person.
Gorgeous.
And they had such a rivalry going that the intendant in Vienna put them on stage together often so that he could sell out the house, and then he had them exit by different doors, because if they exited by the same door, not only would they throw daggers at each other, but their fans would start to have fighting. Who is this horrible person that you sang on stage with, you know, whoever the camp was. And that went on and on and on, and like I say, until these ladies were very, very old. Lehmann lived till she was 88 years old, and Yuritsa until she was 92. And they kept this hatred of each other going. Yuritsa hated Lehmann so much that she was already the prima donna assoluta of the Metropolitan Opera, and prevented Lehmann from going there.
Yes.
Until Lehmann was already 44 years old. 46. She got there in 1934. She was 46 years old. That was one more strike against Yuritsa as far as... And so Yuritsa had to retire before Lehmann could sing at the Met. So I got ahead of myself. She sang... she was the first composer in Ariadne auf Naxos of Strauss. Strauss wrote Intermezzo, Christine Storch, for her. He wrote Arabella for her, and he wrote the Frau ohne Schatten, the Färberin, the dyer's wife, was written for Lehmann. So that she did the world premieres of these roles, and so it's in the record books that she accomplished this. She also did some world premieres of lesser-known operas that get forgotten, you can imagine, over the years. The world premieres that would happen and then get forgotten. In those years in Vienna, she started singing lieder, but she didn't consider herself to be a real lieder singer until her opera career started to wane, when she moved here just before the Anschluss. Everybody here knows what the Anschluss meant, what that means, yes? No, Anschluss is where Hitler came in and took Vienna, took Austria, that's the Anschluss. She left her husband's first wife was Jewish. That meant that her stepchildren were half Jewish by their mother, and that's how Jews were judged by the Nazis. If your mother was Jewish, you are Jewish, and you should be exterminated. And so then she helped her husband and those kids escape. She escaped easily because she wasn't Jewish, and she had been coming and going so much. And so that she moved full-time to the States in 38, and then her career as an opera singer got less and less. Her biggest role was the Marschallin in Der Rosenkavalier, and she sang that pretty much until 1945. She came back for Lauritz Melchior's 25th year to sing the first act Die Walküre, sing Sieglinde with him, when she was already in her 50s. But it was a great occasion for both of them. And then she retired to sing full-time, and I mean full-time, lieder. And this is in a country which was fighting the Nazis. Mm. The Americans were trained to hate Germans, and here this German lady comes out on stage and sings in German. And she got away with it. She had a lovable nature. And she also mixed French and English songs into her rep, so that she didn't sing pure German lieder during the war. And if you want to see what she thought of Hitler, read the postscript to her own bio. She wrote 7 books, 5 pedagogical books, a novel, and her autobiography. The postscript in 1938 is so vitriolic to Hitler. And you can read that on the Lehmann website. The Lotte Lehmann website has excerpts from her books. She was also a painter, a poet. And then, as I say, she finished her career in 1951 as a leader singer. In 51, she had already done the work to establish the Music Academy of the West starting in 1948, and then she moved to Santa Barbara full-time to be the prima donna assoluta of the Music Academy of the West, establishing it really, to some degree, year-round, because she lived there year-round. Then she gave private lessons in the wintertime and public lessons, as well as private lessons.
Gary, I wanted to ask you, wasn't there a first production of Sauerflöte?
Das war sicher.
Oh, but I remember reading in a book the people that were involved in that production. They were like some of the most famous musicians and people from Europe. There was Zweig, conductor.
Fritz Zweig.
He was the, oh, that's an alarm. He was the music director of the Berlin Staatsoper. And his wife was a prima donna. As a Jew, he had to escape to the States. He couldn't conduct anymore in Germany. And there was, the stage director was the man who was in Ghent, Herbert Grof. And he was an extremely famous stage director. He was in Zurich and Geneva. He was in Tétard. It was like these world famous people of this quality. And Bruno Walter always was in Santa Barbara. I mean, it was pretty, pretty famous. Probably Schoenberg was also in this circle of friends.
Well, and then Jascha Heifetz was one of the founders of the
And Thomas Mann, of course.
Thomas Mann was an intimate friend of this whole group of people.
Yeah.
Gregor Piatigorsky was up there giving master classes. Even when I was there, Gregor Piatigorsky was still coming to the Music Academy of the West.
It was such a rich time because of the war, unfortunately, because the war was terrible, but for Los Angeles, it was a totally different cultural scene. It's like what movies are doing today, they did in music in those days, you know? And I don't want to keep interrupting
you mentioned
that Lotte Lehmann sang world premieres. Something important to remember is that in those days, Richard Strauss, he was writing these operas, that music is still fiendishly, it's very, very difficult. It's really hard music. And they were learning those. They didn't have any recordings, or they didn't have the coaches and everything they were reading. Sometimes they would get the notes in the evening and they would prepare for a rehearsal. It was nothing that was like, you know, it was difficult music. His first operas, you know, they were the Chrysotomus and everything. It was not melodic for their ears.
Well, even if you think of the, for those of you who know the Frau ohne Schatten, Woman Without a Shadow.
Yeah,
you don't come away singing the tunes of Frau ohne Schatten.
Hard music to learn. So I want to tell a little Lotte Lehmann story.
Please.
She had a concert with some other famous singers. They were all famous. And Richard Strauss was in the audience. He might have been conducting, but I know he was in the audience. And they did the final trio from Rosenkavalier. And she made a bunch of mistakes, and the whole thing almost fell apart. She was doing the Octavian, I believe. No, it was that Maria Olszewska who did the opera. So she did the Marshaline. And she came up to Richard Strauss afterwards, and she said to him, "Oh, I'm so sorry, maestro. I made such a big mistake. I made big mistakes." And, you know, hoping that he would say, "Oh, that's okay. Oh, that's okay." He said, "Tell me, my dear, what was right?" You know, that was so typical. Richard Strauss was, he would say, like, "Voice di casa," if it went really bad or something. He'd say, "Where? Just show me where the I can get my check." Things didn't perturb him. I mean, when you listen to his leader, you would think, "Oh my God, it's the Albert Einstein of come." And he was from Munich, and he was easygoing, and you know. And wasn't there a little incident that the wife of Richard Strauss didn't like Lehmann as much? It could be a jealousy, because she prevented Lotte Lehmann from even doing more world premieres with Richard Strauss, because they took another singer, this conductor,
You're thinking of the conductor. The wife of Krauss.
Clemens Krauss.
And that was
she was a witch.
Yeah, and that's Viorica Ursulea.
It was also a singer, right?
Yeah, so Ursulea was horned in on Lehmann as soon as...
Yeah.
Well, Krauss was Richard Strauss's favorite
best
conductor.
Friend, yeah.
And real good friend. And in fact, wrote the Capriccio wrote the Capriccio libretto for Strauss. He was that close to him. And so that if Krauss said, "My wife should sing the first cast of something," then Ursulea. If you ever can get a hold of an Ursulaiac recording, Viorica Ursulaiac. It's a party record. If you listen to it today, she whines and she's off pitch, and it's some of the ugliest singing you'll ever hear in your life. But she was the wife, first the mistress, and then the wife of Clemens Krauss. So that's how she.
Yeah.
How she
and then there was another thing. Lotte Lehmann was also quite a romantic figure. She was good looking, and she had a lot of admirers. And among them was Giacomo Puccini. That was, and there were evidently, there was always this gossip that when she sang Madame Butterfly, and did she do the Turandot or not?
She did. She did the Vienna premiere of Turandot.
With him. And then he fell madly in love with her, being an Italian. And there were a big series of love letters, which she burned.
You're sure now you're thinking of Toscanini?
No, of Puccini.
Because there were all those love letters that we still have between her and Toscanini.
Yeah, well,
she got around.
Both
she was, you know, she says she was romantic.
I said it nicely.
Yes, she said it nicely. There might be some other words that you might use.
She was a flirt.
She was a flirt. She knew what the stuff that she was made of and how it would attract men. And her voice could attract men. That's how she got her first husband.
Yes.
Her only husband.
Yes.
He fell in love with her, never having met her.
Her Bühnenerscheinung, they say in German, you know. Her stage
presence.
Presence. So I won't interrupt you anymore.
I just got in the story to the Music Academy of the West. In alphabetical order, here are some of the students of Lotte Lehmann. Janine Altmaier. Grace Bunbury, Marilyn Horn, Lotte Mansouri, Mildred Miller, Norman Mittelman, and Benita Valente. These are the people whose names, you know, you buy the recordings of and that you know. She taught hundreds and hundreds of other people whose names are not so familiar, but who went on to good careers or to teaching careers. And that's why I've established this tribute to Lehmann. The first the CD came out, and now the second one that Janine has sung for, she sang the Gretchen am Spinnrad for the second one, will not be a CD, but on the Lehmann Foundation website where you can download them like iTunes. But if you want to, you can buy the first CD or download it from iTunes also, one at a time, or sample 30 seconds of each one. And you'll hear former students and colleagues of Lehmann speaking and or singing. Grace Bunbury singing. So I think that's fun. And then on the second one, there are people like Marilyn Horn, Carol Nevlin. I forgot to mention Carol Nevlin, another student of Lehmann.
Really good singer.
Time for music?
Yes.
So when she retired, she stopped the Music Academy of the West and began teaching only private lessons to people like Janine Altmaier.
Well, I met her at the Music Academy. She did come back the summer of 69. I hope that's the right name. And she taught leader classes that summer.
Master classes.
Yeah.
And did you sing in those master classes?
Yes. And Sangir, I was Sangir's student. He gave me the most rinky-dink song to sing. And I think it was so that my voice would sound really bad, you know. It was really, it was a little Schubert lead of some something about a bloomer, or, you know, it was, and it didn't suit my voice at all. And then all of Lotte Lehmann's friends said, you know, this girl, Janine's going to sing, and he's given her a terrible song. There was always all this intrigue at the Music Academy between Sangair and the whole world, you know? There still is. I'm not amazed. Anyway, so they got to Lotte Lehmann, and they said, you have to take control of this, you know? And I got a big song then. Like, I think it was Von Ewige Liebe or something like that. It was a big song, you know, where I could really show off and really act it out. And she, you know, so she did intervene. I mean, she took action.
She was still emeritus at that time. You know?
Yeah.
She was still
those classes were fabulous.
Yeah. Well, let's hear Lehmann sing. Do you want to start with Von Ewige Liebe? No, I don't have that.
Stenchen? Beautiful.
Stenchen.
I mean, whatever you want.
Okay. The reason that we're doing Stenchen, does everybody here know Strauss's Stenchen?
Mach auf.
Don't
play so much.
But the reason that we're doing this is that Lehmann was famous or infamous for having trouble with her breath control. She made her weakness a strength. And I want you to listen to this, especially the last two notes of this song.
And her voice for this song, well, you know, you can say it, today it's almost always sung by really light voices, and her voice was heavier, so it's very interesting, the vocal color of the song. And
I held up the fingers, she doubled the top note. I was in a master class with Sanger. The year I got to the Music Academy of the West, Sanger had taken over. And the singer had sung that song and doubled the top note. Madame Lehmann came to the last class, even when she wasn't teaching, she came to the last master class of each year. I happened to be sitting with her that day, and he kind of scratched his head. Remember, he was a specialist in the melodie, rap. And he kind of scratched his head, and he said, I think that's right, Madame Lehmann. And without a moment, her legs were already giving away. She stood her full strength, and she said, "Ja, Strauss told me." And the place broke up in laughter. So she had that kind of authority. And now you hear recordings with people only doing the one measure written because it hasn't been passed down that high note that the pianist just does the same chord twice. Perfectly good. Tell us more about this song.
Well, what Gary was laughing at and why this song is so famous is because she takes a breath in the middle of a word and big time. I mean, it's big time. But she goes, "Von der Vorne Schauer, der Nacht." So what he meant, she turns it into a virtue. And I always did it because I think it sounds so beautiful. But the word is Vorne Schauer, der Nacht. It's one word, you know. And so, and I was laughing also because she used to tell me, you know, if the high note is difficult, do a portamento. And did you hear? For that style and for that time, those portamentos were really on the grenze of good taste, you know. Only Lotte Lehmann could get away with it, you know. I mean, she did it. It was so characteristic of her singing. It was
really
beautiful.
Was. Really
yeah.
Was.
Yeah.
I'd like to play Der Männer Sippe because this is a role which Janine has also made famous, the Sieglinde. And you can see, you can borrow this if you're on Netflix or buy it if you're not, with Boulez conducting it at Bayreuth. And she does a beautiful job of it. And I'd like you to hear, does everyone here know essentially what's happening in Der Männer Sippe? If you don't, raise your hand. That's too bad. She, Sieglinde, is complaining to Siegmund, who she just met, what has happened to her. The horde of the people who were her husband's family, she was forced into marrying. She didn't choose to marry this guy. This group of people were mean to her. And in the middle of all of this meanness, here came, we know who it is. She didn't know who it is. It's Der Wanderer. This is Wotan, comes walking in. And you hear her say, "Tief hing der Hut," the hat hung deeply over one eye. Remember, he gave one eye for Fricka. That's in a different opera. Anyway, he is the one who puts the sword into the ash tree of the world where they happen to live. And she's saying all of this to Siegmund because the man who can pull it out will be the savior of the world, more or less, and save her. Of course, she doesn't know it at that time. They are twins, they fall in love, and that's a whole other story.
I just wanted to say something else to listening to Leyland's voice again, is that how you realize that in the good old days, everyone's always going to talk about the good old days, but these vocalists were so distinctive in their vocal timbre. Today, to me, a lot of people sound exactly alike. I don't know whether that is because the teachers are teaching so well and their technique is so perfect. Lehmann had a flawed technique, but what's so fascinating is the very distinctive voices. I would know instantly who Lotte Lehmann was, or instantly who Franco Corelli was, or Kirsten Wagstad, or Leonie Riesenick. You could never mix their voice up with another singer. And that is such a virtue, I think, you know?
At the moment when she finally tells Siegmund this, you will hear this recording, that is Lauritz Melchior. I'll let you hear a few notes of Lauritz Melchior. And this is being conducted by Bruno Walter, the best of the best at that time. Well, didn't do it.
That's Lohengrin.
Tormentos sitzt aus hier im Saal, von Hunding zur Hochzeit geladen. Freut ein Weib, das ungefragt Schächer ihm schenkte zur Frau.
Die S.C.H.
Traurig saß ich, während sie tranken, ein Fremder trat da.
Natural from her breast, it's the most perfect mixture of breast voice going into her head voice, and she did it on pure instinct. There's no artifice in that at all. This is just how she would speak it. She didn't have to think about it. That was natural singing. That is how it should be, but it's hard. That's hard. But she didn't have technique like that. It came, this was just natural. And this is really a good example of it. Goes to B's and it goes up to E. Hard tessitura for soprano. Listen. That's going up into her head voice. Now she's going
gentle.
Head voice again. Did you hear any?
Doch das andere Strahl,
want to draw your attention to the way that she is able to use consonants. Tränen und Trost, because the way Wagner wrote a lot of things, he liked Schächer und Schenken so proud. He loved to have alliteration, but not one right after the other. But it was like interior rhyme that way. So when Tränen und Trost, when he looked at her, and only at her did Wotan look. It brought tears and trust.
That's a comfort.
Comfort. At the same time, tears and comfort at the same time.
Tränen und Trost. Tränen! That little, it's not exactly a portamento, but it's a slight lifting up of her voice, and it makes it like a sob in the voice. It's just, it's
without
so
sobbing,
good.
Without breaking.
It's so good.
The voice did not break.
And it's hard to do that. And the conductor,
I want to go back just for Tränen und Trost zu gleich.
That's sweet.
How she does her 16th notes.
Yeah, they're really good.
How she bounces,
yeah,
on the 16th.
Yeah, I was trying to tell other singers, like, throw the knees. They're so exciting when you do 16th notes like that with that schmoo, like what Lehman called it.
Did you hear what she was doing? Listen to these 16th notes again.
Yeah, it bounces the voice, and it gives the energy. If you are lazy on your dotted notes, you know, it loses half of what you're singing about.
And she's getting more and more
so
powerful.
Exciting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At this point in the aria, she's saying that she now knows why that sword was put there. Of course, it's for sequence study. Now I knew. And it's now it gets more really exciting with the dotted notes. She didn't have that top note.
It was pretty good. It's just like an eighth note. It's like zoom,
You got to get it right on it. I wouldn't criticize that.
Is it B natural?
It's an A.
I heard it.
Unless they have great voices and are great singers. That's why you get famous. And that's really great.
I mean, but there's lots of great voices and great singers.
Yeah, but they're not exciting.
Why is that so exciting?
Because she has vocal flaws and
well, so we all should strive for vocal flaws.
No! But the exactly. And it's in spite of that, that makes the voice exciting. I love that it's on the edge. You know, it's edgy. What I mean by she's not at the limit of her capacities, but she's working. You know, and you hear that, and that's brilliant. I mean, that moves you. That not only does she have, as I said, that extremely natural vocal technique, that you don't get the impression that she's placing the tones or singing with any caution. She throws that away. I don't know what it, I mean. It's hard, isn't it hard to say what moves you? I know other people would just hate that, probably hate this recording, even though she was so famous. But I know there's people who like only listen to Baroque music and Mozart that would not enjoy that kind of singing. Because they don't like to hear a voice that isn't like an instrument or sings
you
like an instrument.
In person too.
You do.
Well,
and I think the
voice.
conviction of her words, the conviction of her words. I mean, it must have been. And there's one other thing that you have to put in context. As in these days, singers came on stage. They rehearsed the opera once. They brought their own costumes. There was a little guy who was called a stage director, and he used to tell them where they stood on the stage. No one worked with the singers for months like they do today for a production, like, you know, like movie directors that stage operas and they want you to do this, or like Robert Wilson and things like that. No one did that. And Lotte Lehmann was so revolutionary in this. Melchior probably was still of the old school, and I know Flachstadt was, because you can see pictures of her. And if I saw some film on TV that she came on the stage and she had the greatest voice on earth and she just stood there and sang. For Flachstadt, that was enough. For Lotte Lehmann, it was another world. She would never do that. And later on, Callas did the same thing for Italian opera, and that's why she got so famous, because that was revolutionary. People didn't do that in those days. There was no, staging was unimportant, but not when Lotte Lehmann sang.
One time, Flachstadt was the Brunhilde, Lehmann was the Sieglinde.
Oh, a few times, yeah.
And she came off the stage, and she, after doing this first act, she said, "That's something you should only be doing with your husband."
She was a Norwegian.
She was Norwegian, very straight-laced. She's married to a Norwegian. So she knows.
But, you know, Flachstadt, she just would, she would never, like, I never kneel down on the stage. It just would, you don't do that. But I did a really big faux pas, one of the biggest that I can remember. Speaking of Kirsten Flockdott and Lotte Lehmann, I was a big Flockdott fan. It was like, you know, I listened to every recording, and I tried to imitate her voice when I was like in my early 20s, and I said to her, after having, I went to a lesson with Lehmann, and I listened all afternoon before the lesson to Kirsten Flockdott singing the aria. And I came, and I said to her, what was it like to sing with Kirsten Flockdott on the same stage?
Did she curse you for asking the question?
She blew me off. She just said something like, it was normal. That's how she was. She could be really bitchy. And I can't believe I would have asked her that. But you see, I knew Lotte Lehmann, and I didn't know Kirsten Flockdott. And in later years, I realized what a dumb little moron I was. I mean, probably Lehmann was, as an artist, probably twice the artist of Flockdott. But Flockdott had this incredible organ. She was just a great singer. But I wanted to tell you something else aside from this. I did a lot of Valkyries, and there started then to come younger stage directors during the time that I was singing. I sang still with the old guard, like Corelli and Caballé, who were of the stand and sing school, and they were really great. I mean, there were great performances. I'm not criticizing them. But then, little by little, there started becoming really famous regisseurs who would stage these operas, and they would only work with thin people, or not thin people, but people who looked good on stage, and many people criticized that. But I remember when older singers would start working in these younger productions and stuff, and the clash was enormous, like at the Met and everything. Like, they would come to rehearsals. We would come, Peter Hoffman, that was a really favorite singer of mine. You know, like, we would come in blue jeans because we'd be rolling all over the floor. Like, I'd have to wash my hair like twice a day and stuff. We were filthy at the end of rehearsals. And other people, like, that would sing Fricka, no names, they came in heels, red dress, big hairdo, jewelry, and they sang. They did a staging rehearsal. And I'm not joking. This was really a clash. And I don't know how it is today. I'd be really curious to go to a staging rehearsal and see what's going on, you know? But that was such an interesting, and I'm sure that probably was a little bit of the same even in the 20s and stuff, you know?
What they said, what I've been reading about, was almost exactly what you're saying, that in spite of the way that it was directed in those days, stand here and move so you don't bump into him when you're leaving the stage, that Lehmann staged herself, and that was part of the revolution, that she was doing things that you only did with your husband, kind of thing. That when she made love with Lars Melchior on stage, it really looked pretty passionate, that kind of thing. Earlier this week, we heard a very passionate performance of Dich Teue Halle. And before we hear Lehmann's version of it, I know you studied Elisabeth with her. What would she have to say about this? For instance, just a stage direction.
Okay, well, we always acted out our arias, but I remember I sang it, when I sang it the first time, her big question to me, she could hardly wait, because I saw her right after, we went to Salzburg after my first performance, and she said, did they applaud after your aria? And I said, no, because in Wagner you don't ever break the music. And I said, no, were they supposed to? And she goes, And I said, do they always applaud after your Dich Teue Halle? Yeah. Years later, I sang in Munich. I still wasn't very famous, like maybe 2 or 3 years later. And they applauded after my Dich Teue Halle, you know. Well, I was singing with Hans Hoff, and he was a legendary singer and a really great singer. Well, they applauded actually after our duet, you know, when we left the stage. But, I mean, it was most probably more for him than for me, but she was dead, but I really wanted to call her up and say, they applauded, you know? But we did act this, and one of the first times I worked with her, we were doing the second act of Valkyrie, and I came out on the stage, you know, for him fake, and I was young, and I moved my body a lot, you know, and then she couldn't walk very well, but she said, why do you act like a ballet dancer? Why do you do that? You cannot sing like this. She really made fun of me in front of the master class, you know? I mean, and it was... you know, I got really embarrassed and inhibited and everything. But to this, to add out the parts with her and do it phrase by phrase was so important, because I can't tell you how that, every time there would be a phrase that was difficult for me, she would say, just what I was saying to some of the singers the other day, move your body, move your body, you know, don't be stiff. And if there would come a hard phrase, she said, I used to be afraid of that also, but just don't think about it. Think about what you're singing about.
Anything specific to Victoria Haller? Because that's what we're going to play right now.
No, but I mean, well, just phrase by phrase, but you know, nothing specific. I hate to be a party pooper, but it, more in the third act, which was, you know, more difficult. She had a big, big scenario, which I was telling you about. The walk after Elizabeth sings her prayer in the third act, she had me do that over and over again. It was a long walk.
This is after she stopped singing.
Yeah, I can imagine it was her staging where they walked up the stage, and she, at certain points she made a gesture and told Wolfram, no, I can't, you have to go back, and then she would make like a pantomime, my home now is in heaven, and I'm happy, you know. And this pantomime I did for years after, and I got big compliments on that. And I said, it was just Lotte Lehmann. Yeah. I never changed it. Also in Lohengrin, she would say, now you have to shake your hand at that point when the king says to you, you have to shake your head, you know. And I did all that stuff, and not one stage director ever told me that it was bad. So you see, that was such, she was such a, what they would say in German, a Bühnenpferd. She was a stage horse. Not whore, horse. She knew what she was doing. I mean, she had an innate gift for the drama.
But I was told for the Dichtoria Halle that she literally ran on stage.
Oh, always.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, she just said you can't be on the stage when they play the like four measures. You have to come in. That's Elizabeth's entrance. That's like just a couple measures before she.
But literally running.
Run on the stage.
But what does that do for your ability to sing at that point?
If you're into the part, it makes the first phrase really exciting.
it makes it breathtaking.
No. Oh, I had to do a lot more running than that on the stage. But if you were thinking about that, then you should just forget it. Go home. I mean, if that's going to be a consideration. And she always had to come very late. I mean, other stage directors would have had you come on, ta-dum, ba-ba-bum, ba-ba-bum. But this was just like four measures before Dichtoria Halle. And she said it's absolutely impossible to be standing on the stage when they play that. That's why the other night I didn't stand in the middle of the stage, because I can't get out of that habit of, like, at the last minute getting this emphasis in my breath, you know, to get da-da-da-da-da. And if you took a rubato, she would scream. She would just say, it's not an oratorio, you know. It's she is supposed to be out of breath. And the frogrösichtisch, she said, that has to be in tempo too, frogrösichtisch. And then, and she always said, now don't be sad in the next part. So for a long time, you know, I would try to smile and not even on where it gets dark and the music and everything. No, it's not sad. This is, she can hardly wait till he's coming again. And it's really happy. Everything. Not a sad phrase. You know, she has memories of it, but she's not sad when she says, you know, when you left, it was just, she's wondering, and she said to me, she said, she's just amazed that she was so lost when he wasn't there. It's amazing to her. It's more of the wonderment, of wondering about it, you know. How could that be? Die Freude so aus dir. You know, it's more that kind of a, and you'll hear it in her voice.
One question I have before we hear this, on the repeated Sei mir gegrüßt at the end, it always seems to me like a really like sexual kind of a climax. Sei mir gegrüßt, Sei mir gegrüßt. Did she ever talk about that?
No, but she did say to sing it. No, she didn't. But she did say to sing it soft. You know,
to start.
And always she was very she would tell me things about the music. This da 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 da. That's her heart beating. Yes. It's very exciting. I mean, the music in Tannhäuser, some of, and it's early Wagner. When you think of it, it's so grandiose, and the chorus is, I think, I mean,
I forgot what number we're on.
And then the breath at the end, many conductors didn't like a breath, but she's always, I hope she does in this recording, but she always wanted a big breath. I'm here again, to really.
What is that top note? Is that a B flat?
No, it's a B natural.
B natural. Remember that if you've read anything about Lehmann, they always say Lehmann had no top.
Mm-hmm. Oh, she did too.
I lost it again.
Funny enough, I'm amazed at her singing voice. I haven't heard it for a few years. It's exactly like her speaking voice was, even when she was like in her 80s, you know? It had the same quality.
Is that the...
When are we supposed to stop?
What time is it?
It's just about. You better hurry up and play it. We have just enough time.
Prolong the ge on the gegrüßt. Sein ihr gegrüßt.
And she always would hold the final note, you know. Yeah, very exciting.
Is it time?
Yeah, no. Unfortunately. Yeah.
We go until 2.
I think that there's a 15-minute break
probably
now.
Right.
But, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, just excuse me for 1 second, and we can continue to the other students. Come. Why don't you play something else? And...
So maybe you want to take a choice. We have Erin Koenig with her making her own introduction to it. This is a radio broadcast. We have Hinweg, which you heard Janine already talking about, the second act of the Valkyrie. This is where she was talking about moving too much. Sieglinde is crazed with anguish at this point. And probably in Lehmann's interpretation, she was crawling in kind of a tantrum. So we have that Hinweg. We have Dagegen Erheben from Rosenkavalier. We have Zu Eignung, your favorite song. Der Tod, das ist die kühle Nacht, Brahms. And Einsame trüben Tage by Wagner. Requests?
Definitely the broadcast.
The broadcast, okay. It's interesting to hear her speak and tell you what she's about to sing. You all may know that I met her when I was 19 years old and she was 74, and I got to know her for a couple of years, and then she stayed in touch with me, and I would go back to Santa Barbara and meet her. She changed my life. This woman at 74 had more charisma in her little finger than most people have in their whole beings throughout their whole lives, much less at 74. She was a genius that touched my life and completely altered my life forever when I was a snot-nosed kid of 19. I'm 65. How many years? And I have no less passion for what she represented in my mind then, now at 65, than I had when she first awakened my ears to Lieder and opera. She was the one who did it. I would have gone through my life a hard-nosed double bassist who would have just thought of singers as second-class musical citizens.
Certainly like one more song, Madame Lehmann.
I would like to sing the Erlking Franz. The poem is by Goethe. The listener must feel the eeriness of the stormy night through which the father rides with his child deathly sick in his arms. He must feel the longing care of the father as he tries to quiet the mounting fear of the feverish child, terribly frightened of the Erlking who exists only in the child's imagination. He must feel the anguish of the child who in terror hears the voice and sees the face of the sinister ghostly figure, the terrifying phantom of the Erlking to whom he finally succumbs. He must see the Erlking in his misty shroud, the evil fatal look, and hear the malicious whispering voice, and always the storm and the racing hoofs of the horse up to the breathless climax. In his arms, the child was dead.
Did you hear how much drama she had in just saying the story? This is live, no second takes on any of this.
Idyll und Befall, Säule der Wind. meet me again. Eine Töchter sollen die Schwarzen schön, meine Töchter führen in nächtlichen Rhein. Sie wiegen und tanzen und singen die Dein. Sie wiegen und tanzen und singen die Dein. Mein Vater, mein Vater, wo steht du nicht dort? Erkel die Töchter und die
voices,
you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course,
and
you had the
contrast.
Voices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, big contrast. Hard to do that.
Did you sing this song with her?
No, no. Mm-hmm.
But you did do.
Well, there's a reason. There was a reason I didn't study as much Lied with her, because she thought that people who sang opera should never sing Lied. She was very against that. She said it was completely wrong.
Because.
Yeah, I wanted to add.
Yeah, it was one of her big things.
Why is it?
Because you think too much about your voice and you about making tones and stuff and sing too loud and just the wrong style. Because a lot of these songs, they, like this one, they tell a story. I mean, you know, and they're very subtle. And she felt like a person, an opera singer, was too much, you know, too present, too much there, and that they wouldn't have the artistry. I guess she thought you got that only when you're older. She might be right.
But you sang Lieder all your life.
No, I studied Lieder, you know, and we were forced to in school and stuff like that. And of course, I did recitals, and I would do those songs that I was doing recitals with her. You know, I mean, it's not that we just didn't do Lieder, but we, you know, I didn't do nearly as much Lieder as like some of our other students. You know,
who were more Lieder students?
Uh huh.
And you did the Wagnerian rep, but what else besides Eva Elisabeth Sieglinde and
Elsa?
Well, besides that, what else did you study with her?
Fidelio a little bit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And, you know, these Von Ewige Liebe, Zueignung, other things, the Strauss songs, the larger songs, okay? Not, I didn't do, you know, a lot of Schumann and Schubert. In fact, she didn't want me to sing the Frauenleben. She thought that my voice was too high for it and stuff. She had very, very definite tastes.
Did you feel at the end that you had gotten everything that you wanted to get from her as a teacher of only interpretation?
No, you never feel that. I don't wish it now, but I wish then that I had been 10 years older and much more mature, because I didn't appreciate what was just thrown at me, you know, like that. I was 19. I was 20. And I was interested in boys all the time, in boys surfing, what else? You know, hanging out, you know, at the music academy. I mean, it was like, you know, oh, big deal, you know. I mean, like my first rehearsal in Salzburg, I got a contract to sing with Karajan. I sang for him in Berlin, and I mean, I hardly knew who he was.
Oh, no.
I was such a punk, you know? And he asked me, you know, if I was free for dinner, and I remember that my agent stepping in right away, no, she has to go to bed, she's getting up early tomorrow. And that was because he didn't want Karajan to see how dumb I was,
oh,
you know? I mean, this is true, you know. And he was a nice man, and I don't think he invited me to dinner because he thought, you know, I was a babe or anything like that. He wanted to, you know who he was going to work with and stuff. And I got an engagement with him, you know. But I remember in Salzburg, I asked Thomas Stewart, one of my colleagues, I said, do you really think she's such a good conductor? And he looked at me just like that. He, you know, like, poor thing. You know, hopeless. And he said, you know, that you even asked me that question, and I was so chastised. I mean, I was like, you know, I realized, and he said, you can't even compare him to other conductors. That's God. And you see, probably if I'd known how great he was or something, and I mean, Lotte Lehmann sort of played him down, okay? She told me, oh, he was just a conceited little coro petito when I sang in Salzburg and everything, and he was always very arrogant. So I always had this image in my mind about, you know, he was just this little corpetitor and playing for Toscanini and all these people and stuff, you know. And she sort of was like, she remained sort of a diva, you know. I didn't really live in the real world as far as that was concerned. And that's why I said I wish I had been more mature, because I would have taken 100 times more what I than that.
Did you ever record any of your lessons?
Oh, probably. I probably have them somewhere. She didn't like that very much. And also, I asked her one time, I want to pay you, you know, I should pay you. And I said, can you make me a bill? And she said, no, I cannot. I'm not a Schuster. she was grand, you know? She was like, she could get you with a needle. I mean, she could be vicious.
Do you think that it was... on purpose, that she was trying to needle you into something?
No.
It was just her nature.
No, she just didn't tolerate fools, you know. She was very grand, you know, in Santa Barbara and everything. She was really famous. I mean, what is so tragic now is that in our day and age, Montecito is now full of these dot-com billionaires and entertainment industry people, you know, and they're filthy rich. And if you would go around town in Montecito, aside from the people that go to the music academy, you say, you know, I was a student of Lotte Lehmann, or if you mention anything, that you get blank looks. We are in such a cultural wasteland now. You know, that's another topic, but in those days, it was not the case. Lotte Lehmann was the queen of Santa Barbara, and of the world. I mean, she was... I got into a taxi cab. If you want to hear more stories...
Oh, I love them.
We got into a taxi cab in Salzburg. And we were there together, and we were staying at this hotel outside of town that she stayed at. She had a routine, and she never varied from that. The same chauffeur picked her up in Zurich and drove her to Salzburg. It was a huge, long trip, but she never would fly that last part of the trip. And we took a taxi cab for some reason. I don't know. We had been somewhere out to dinner or something. We were taking it to the hotel, and she was sitting in the back seat, and I sat up in the front seat next to the driver. And it was this man, and he was really interested in music, and he said, why are you here, and everything, and I said, well, I'm singing in the festival, and he said, you are, and he went on and on and on, and then, I can't remember how we got on the topic, and I asked him, who do you think who was your favorite composer, because he had played in the orchestra, if you can believe it, now he's driving a taxi, but he had played in the orchestra, and he said, oh, it's the greatest opera of all is Fidelio, of course, because the greatest composer wrote it. And I said, well, my teacher is sitting in the back seat, and she was the most famous Leonora on earth. And he said, who was your teacher? And I said, Lotte Lehmann. And he said, like, he put on the brakes. and he looked in the rearview mirror, and he said, whoa, whoa, which was horrible. And he said, where, wait, which one is she? Because she was old and had a scarf on her head. Like, she always wore this babushka. And I said, that's her right there. And he was, oh, my gnädige Frau. And you know, all this crap that they do and everything. I mean, the man was just speechless that he had her in the taxi cab, you know. It was like, it probably was the most exciting thing that had happened to him. I think he had probably even maybe played the orchestra when she sang or something. Yeah. As an old man. Mm. It was really neat. It was a neat, like, except that he didn't recognize it right away. Of course, that was kind of bad, but.
She's going
incognito.
Janine, I have to go.
We got to start. Okay.